Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Esther. What you could do is you could speak to me, Esther, and then I'll repeat it. Okay, that'll work. Okay, interesting question. The question is to distinguish the differences between the vaccine, the virus, and the disease. And if you are vaccinated and immune, are you still able to harbor the virus and or shed the virus particles? So we'll start with the virus. The virus is the infective agent that causes COVID-19 disease. COVID-19 disease is a disease that has an enormous spectrum. So that's a little unusual. Part of the reason that we understand that the spectrum is so wide is because there's so many millions of people that have it. So it includes people being infected and being able to shed the virus, but not even being aware of the fact that they have it. It includes people that are very mildly ill with something that approximates a mild cold, which is actually something we see quite commonly. And it includes people who become deathly ill with respiratory symptoms. And it also includes people who have life-threatening thromboembolic symptoms. So those are symptoms caused by clots, clots forming in their veins and those clots moving to areas of their body, including the lungs and the brain. And most distressingly, the thromboembolic or clot type syndromes we've been seeing in younger people without any other medical illnesses. Now, fortunately, that's rare, but it's also been very tragic. The vaccine is directed at the clinical disease. So the endpoint in terms of development of the vaccine and the thing that we have strong proof as to the effectiveness of the vaccine is the prevention of disease that would be severe enough to cause you to be in the hospital or disease that would be severe enough to kill you. And we know it's 95% effective against that. So the first thing to realize is 95% is not 100%. So that means that there are people who are vaccinated and have an immune response and still potentially could become sick enough to be in the hospital or to die. And that would be 5 people out of 100. So, but certainly, that is a much higher effectiveness than we've seen with many vaccines and many treatments that we have. There's really virtually nothing we have in therapeutic medicine that is 100% effective. And I will say there's very, very few things we have that are more than 80% effective. In medicine, we kind of have the 80-20, 60-40 rules, which is most of the things that we have that are therapeutically effective are generally, for whatever reason, seem to fall into the about 60% or 80% effectiveness. You'll see there's a lot of new vaccines that are coming out that have about a 50% effectiveness or 60. And you might ask yourself, well, why in the world would we even want to spend our time on that? Well, that is still a very, very effective vaccine at stopping the pandemic. If we had a large percentage of the population immunized with a vaccine that's 60% effective, it could stop the pandemic. So those are still very valid approaches to vaccination. You hear about the AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson vaccines. Now those vaccines are built on a completely different platform. And I'll speak, I know this wasn't part of the question, but I'll speak to it since I think it's kind of cool and probably people, you're going to hear more about it. So those vaccines are built on the use of an adenovirus capsid. So that means the capsule or the outer coating that exists on adenovirus. So everybody in this room, everybody on the Zoom, we've all had many adenoviruses. They cause the common cold. There's 60 or 70 of them that cause mild disease in human beings. And what they contain inside is a little piece of genetic material. That's what if you go out in nature and you sample all of the adenoviruses, they all have a lipid coat or a coating made out of fat, and then very special fat. And then in the inside is a little piece of genetic material. Now, what this vaccine is it's that coat containing a piece of DNA that codes for the spike protein. So the way that virus works is it goes into the cell, it goes into the nucleus of the cell, and it injects that piece of DNA into the nucleus. Then the nucleus takes the instructions off that piece of DNA and produces messenger RNA, which we talked about earlier. And the messenger RNA goes out into the cytoplasm of the cell. And guess what that codes for? The spike protein. So now we've gone through all of that, and now we are right there at the spot that the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine does, which is that now we have a piece of messenger RNA that codes for the spike protein. It produces the spike protein, and the immune system responds to it. The big advantage of those vaccines is that they only require a single dose. So that's more convenient. It's felt like it's going to be easier for people. I can tell you, as we deal with all of the logistics of giving everybody two doses, it's a big project. So having the ability to just give one dose is certainly a big advantage. Going back to the question, the issue of whether or not you're able to still be infected with the COVID-19 vaccine and shed it has not been completely determined, but undoubtedly some people are able to do that. But what is the rate of that? The initial data that are coming back look like it is greatly diminished, but I am certain that there will still be some. You say, well, why would that be? Well, we have two kinds of antibodies. We have one kind that lives on the surfaces of our mucous membrane. So like inside of our mouth, in the lining of our gut, we have antibodies. They're called IgA. And the vaccine produces a humoral immunity of a type that lives in our bloodstream, which is called IgG or IgM. So it seems possible, theoretically, and probably likely, that the virus could set up an infection that would live only in somebody's nose, and that the vaccine would not the antibodies produced by the vaccine might not have access to that. But that certainly is something that's going on right now in everybody who is not vaccinated. So nothing unusual about that. Josh Knuckles. Let's see, we can maybe allow Josh's microphone to go on. Josh, try unmuting yourself.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I don't know if everyone else can. And I will repeat the question after you ask it.
That's fine. So I had a question based upon my age at 26 years old. I was trying to figure out if you guys have the ability to get this vaccine put together so fast based on, like you said, the amount of people that have contracted the disease and how popular the disease is itself. How can we actually understand the long-term effects of the disease based upon my age? Is it worth it for me to take the risk to not have the vaccine done, because what are the chances of me living on this island and actually contracting this disease and having the long-term effects of this disease in comparison to not having the long-term effects of the results of the vaccine?
Thanks, Josh. It's a interesting and complicated question, but I think it's really, really good. If you go ahead and turn off your mic and I'll try to answer it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So Josh says that he's 26 years old and he is trying to understand the relative risk of taking a vaccine, which understandably, you know, we haven't studied the vaccine for 10 years or 20 years, and he wonders there may be some long-term lingering risk related to that. And he's trying to balance that against his fairly accurate view that he's at low risk of actually having a dangerous COVID-19 infection. And also he's living in Wrangell, which has had a very, very low incidence of COVID-19. So he's trying to balance those two for himself. So Josh, I think, of course, you're gonna have to answer those questions for yourself. And let me give you one perspective on it. And it's the perspective of a physician myself that's trying my very best to ensure the safety of all people in Southeast Alaska to the greatest degree possible. So there's a number of things about the vaccine that are inescapable, as you mentioned. And one is that we haven't had a chance to observe it for 10 years or 20 years. However, my view of that as a physician and a scientist is that the actual content of the vaccine is such that I feel lingering long-term effects are highly unlikely, given the fact that it's based on a molecule that exists in abundance in your body, which is messenger RNA. It exists in every single cell. Every single cell in your body has the enzymes to degrade the messenger RNA fragment. Of course, you know, that's a scientific supposition. It's based on good science and strong science, but nevertheless, it's impossible to answer that question experimentally. With regards to what is your role in controlling the pandemic? What we know is that young people are a strong reservoir for disease that kills old people. So I strongly recommend that young people do get the vaccine, and I recommend that they do it out of a sense of civic duty to protect the older members of our society. And I recommend that strongly for all people in Southeast Alaska. This pandemic is not over. And the idea that somehow the trajectory that we're on right now is going to stay the same is probably, it's hopefully true, but there's no guarantee. And nobody's been asking today about mutations. I've been getting lots of questions about mutations, but I will say that the virus will continue to evolve as all viruses do. And it may be that there will be a new strain of this virus that's more infectious that the vaccine will be partially effective towards. And for that reason, I do recommend that you do get vaccinated, Josh. And I'm not saying that in a sense that I want you to be afraid, but I feel that it is, as those of us that are younger should be getting vaccinated to protect the older members of our respective communities. So the viral mutation and evolution is not, in spite of what you may hear in some location, viral mutations are not uncommon. That's why we have to formulate a new form of the flu vaccine every year. There's so many millions of people that have the flu every year. The flu virus continues to mutate and evolve. And so every year we have to come up with a new vaccine to deal with that problem. So this is not a new issue. This is an old issue. It's just, it's a concerning issue for this virus. And if you follow in the scientific literature, what's been going on with mutations, fortunately, we're very fortunate that this virus actually has been mutating and evolving for the most part in areas that have not affected its transmissibility or virulence. But recently we've seen some of that emerging. Looks like Josh wants to follow up. So go ahead and unmute, Josh.
All right, I'm back. So another question that, with that being said, is if I do go ahead and do this vaccine, you're saying that I would not give anyone else that could have a higher chance of receiving greater repercussions of this disease. If I get this vaccine, I will not pass on or carry this COVID-19 at all, right? Is that what you're saying?
So the question is, if he gets this vaccine, will he not be passing this on at all? And the answer is no. This is not a binary thing. So
okay. So with that being said, based on my presumption of my age and my health, whether I take the vaccine or not, I could still carry the disease and give it to somebody that is older than me and a worse position, given like my father with diabetes or, you know, any other family members that are a little bit older that have different health conditions. Either way, I get this vaccine, I could still pass on the virus.
Theoretically.
Okay.
Theoretically, that's true. I mean, I'm not going to speak in absolutes, but I will tell you that what we know is that the likelihood of that occurring is greatly diminished.
Okay, so just like the likelihood
absolutely,
of me.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to make sure others can hear what I'm saying. So the question was whether or not is it possible for him to get the vaccine and then still potentially transmit it to his father who has diabetes, as he explained. And I said the answer is we can't speak in absolutes. I mean, you know, it's 95% effective. Transmissibility of asymptomatic disease is still being determined, but it's greatly diminished. So the safest path of action, Josh, is to get vaccinated.
Okay. I definitely agree with you on that topic, but also why has there been anything pushed out for me to be tested to see if I've actually already carried the virus before and built up my own antibodies? Because if I'm in that situation, wouldn't you agree with me that for this year, we don't know 6 months from now that I could contract it again. But if I've been through the virus and I don't know it just because of my age and I happen to not receive it as difficult as others, wouldn't I not get the vaccine until the next season?
Okay.
Just because there's no reason for me to carry it if I'm going to carry it to somebody else, whether I have the vaccine or not.
Okay, it's a new question and it's a good one. So if you could go ahead and mute and I'll repeat it and I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, if that's okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So he's wondering, well, maybe I've already been exposed and maybe I've already had the wild type and just been asymptomatic. And so then maybe getting vaccinated is extraneous. You know, there's no point in it. So there's a couple of approaches you could take, and it would be possible for you to get an asymptomatic test. There's also possible for you to see your physician and get a antibody test. We do have the ability to send out antibody tests, but I don't recommend that you do that. But it would be possible. You asked about it, and we do have access to that kind of testing. And since you do live with somebody who's susceptible, it's perfectly reasonable for you to get an appointment, discuss it with your physician, and get that test. It's a send out. It takes a little bit of time. And the test would tell you if you had ever been exposed to the virus. It wouldn't tell you if you were currently infected, but it would answer that question for you. The issue of whether or not somebody who's been previously infected with the coronavirus should be vaccinated has been answered definitively by Dr. Fauci and others at the FDA who have looked carefully at this. They feel that the antibody response that you receive from the wild type infection that is asymptomatic is generally very, very mild. In other words, if you're a young person and you encounter this and you have a very mild infection that is probably only carried in your throat and your nose and does not cause systemic disease, that the likelihood of you having long-term lingering immunity is low. As a matter of fact, this has been well documented. There have been numerous people who've had infections of that type that have recurred. And of course, there's also uncertainty because some people, it seems, who have that type of an infection will carry it up to 90 days. So whether they're actually being reinfected or not is also an issue of some uncertainty. However, what's clear is that the antibody response from the vaccine is superior. And so we do recommend, consistent with CDC recommendations, we do recommend strongly that people who have been previously infected with COVID-19, once they're healthy, that they do also get the vaccine. Someone's pointing to somebody for a question. Go ahead. Anybody? Yeah, Lovey. Yes. So I'll repeat the question. The question is, if you've received the Pfizer vaccine, should you also get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? No. If you've received both doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, I do not recommend that you get additional vaccines. They won't. They ultimately code for the exact same protein, and what we know is that the immune response after two doses of the mRNA virus or the mRNA vaccines, it produces a robust immune response. So I don't recommend that you also get the Johnson. It won't be harmful, but it won't be beneficial. So the other question is, when will the children be vaccinated? Doing research with living children for is extremely difficult. Is extremely difficult. The protocols for those types of studies are quite difficult. However, they're being done. They're being done right now. There's really, from a scientific point of view, there's no reason to suspect that there will be problems. But they're doing right now, they're doing stage one and stage two trials. And I do not know when those will be completed, but after that, there'll have to be a stage three trial. My guess is it won't be until the fall. That's a great question. Let me repeat it. So the question is, how effective is the flu shot and that we get every year? And the answer is, it changes year to year. So the way that we do that, so there's always flu circulating the planet, but the flu that lands in North America is generally of a type that is seen the previous spring in pigs in Western China. Now that I, you know, you can think about that. It's just, it's the reality. So human beings and swine are both infected by the same virus, which is the flu virus. And the virus that sweeps across North America almost always is the version that is in the swine in Western China the previous spring. Now, remember I said the flu virus is a very highly mutating virus, and so it changes year to year. So what they do to make the vaccine for the flu is they go over and they sample flu virus over in China every spring. And then they, based on experience, then they formulate a vaccine that's directed towards that version. And sometimes they get it right. And when they get it right, it's 60% effective. And sometimes it's not so good, and it's only 20 or 30% effective. But in either case, the flu vaccine reduces the mortality overall, particularly for elderly patients. So, and it reduces the overall rate of transmission of the flu enough that it prevents it from becoming a bad epidemic. So that's a great example of how a vaccine doesn't have to be 95% effective in order to have a big effect on death and epidemic. So if it slows it down 30%, it's still enough to prevent it from really turning into a wildfire. Yeah. Yeah, Esther. It is reduced. So there's a number of prominent mutations that are occurring around the globe. One that has been very prominent in Great Britain, which is, I think, the J1116, and it is very effective against that. Although it the one that is prominent in South Africa, it is not as effective. And I think it's reduced, and it's on the order of 75 to 80% effective in that. So it's still a very effective vaccine, but it's not the superbly effective vaccine that it is right now here. So still very helpful, enough to be well worth getting. Yeah, story is yet to be completely told. Good question. Other questions? Yeah.
So I just make more of a search setting for people, but do you have a voice of the
great question. So the question is, here in Wrangell, do we have the choice between Moderna and Pfizer? No, you don't. Right now, the vaccine that we're getting here is Moderna. And that's really the only vaccine that we've been able to put into the community. Is really, can I say a couple things about that? The first one is, it's about the practicality of transporting, delivering, storing the vaccine. So in order to store the Pfizer vaccine, we need a super, super cold freezer. And the Moderna vaccine, just a regular cold freezer. So that's one of the issues that's determined where we've had our different vaccines shipped. And then the other thing is that the two vaccines are interchangeable in terms of their effectiveness. And so much so that, the Mayo Clinic where I used to work is now using them interchangeably for the second shot. So because they're their mode of action is identical, and the effectiveness and the side effects profile. Well, the Moderna maybe is has a little more punch. I mean, it's maybe just a tiny bit more effective, and it also seems to have a little more strong side effects. But yeah, really not any significant difference. Yeah, I would be willing to get either one and have my parents or my, you know, members of my family receive either one. And Carly Allen, I know, who's been working. Carly, why don't we give you a microphone and you can speak a little bit to the vaccination work that we're doing here in Wrangell. I think it's like 1 percentage point difference in effectiveness, or maybe 2. They're both converge at 95% effective. Yeah. No. There you go.
All right.
Oh, why don't you come up here and use this? That's just the best thing to do, Carly. Yeah. So I'm going to introduce Carly Allen, who is our director of our outpatient clinic and who has been coordinating all of our vaccine activity here in Sitka. Where am I today? Wrangell. Here in Wrangell. Excuse me. Thanks.
Yeah. First of all, quick thanks to Lovey for spearheading this and Esther and the tribe for making this happen. Dr. Brule for traveling down and for answering the tough questions. We are doing vaccines here in Wrangell. We started late in 2020. We've administered, as you saw, over 1,000 doses in the community at this point. We are actively providing immunizations every week. And right now we are providing appointments for vaccinations for age 55 and up, and quickly moving down our priority list. We have good supply of vaccine in our community, and we expect to move completely down that list during the month of February. So as we get vaccine, we will put it out. We don't have any plans on holding it. We want to get it out into the community as quickly as possible. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for doing such a great job. Right. Should we?
Any additional questions for Dr. Brule?
Yeah, that looks like it. I didn't recommend it for the purpose that Josh was, the person who was asking the question was asking about, you know, whether that should be the trigger as to whether or not he gets a vaccine. But I think for anybody who is living with somebody who's highly susceptible, I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I mean, it gives you some peace of mind and helps to inform your thinking about that. I don't think it's really I think that's really what I can say about it. You know, if I was taking care of you know, sibling who has, you know, who has significant disease, or, you know, a parent, you know, if I was taking care of my mom and she had you know, a number of medical conditions, it would be perfectly reasonable to, or even just living in close proximity in the same household, I think it would be totally reasonable to go and speak with your clinician and request an antibody test. So for those of you who may not be familiar with that, an antibody test is a test where you take a person's blood, spin it down to the serum, send the serum off to a special lab, and then they do a test on that serum to determine if you have antibodies in your blood to the virus. And if you do, then obviously you've had an episode of COVID disease in the past. So, all right, well, we're kind of coming to the end of the hour. I want to thank Esther and all the folks at the tribe, Kunakshish. I want to thank all of you for your polite attention, and those of you who've been on the Zoom call, thanks for calling in, and thanks for asking the excellent questions. And I hope you all have a great day, and stay safe.